If you just started going down the rabbit hole of Bitcoin, you should definitely, besides, all the other books that are out there, the Genius book by Safiya Namouz, Bitcoin Standards, there's one book that you definitely need to read, and that is Layered Money by Nick Bhatia. Either it's a book, ebook, or hardcover. It's called Layered Money: From Gold and Dollars to Bitcoin and Central Bank Digital Currencies. It talks about and goes deep dive into the evolution of monetary systems around the globe and into the origins of how money is evolving into functioning in a layered manner. So we're going to go down different rabbit holes, and so I'm really looking forward to my special guest, Nick Bhatia. He's an adjunct professor at the University of Southern California, Marshall School of Business for Finance and Business Economics, financial researcher. So without further ado, this is my talk with Nick Bhatia. Let me know if you have any questions, comments. Make sure you follow me, follow Nick Bhatia on Twitter, subscribe to my YouTube channel and my podcast show, and let me know your questions. And my email DMs are open. Have fun. Nick Bhatia, thanks so much for coming on my show. Welcome to the show. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me.
Nick, I've been following you for quite some time. You've written a brilliant book. It's the challenging part, I think, is, and you mentioned it in one of your other podcasts or interviews, maybe not challenge, but I think it was also the intention to put it in a succinct manner. Because I think if it was like a more like comprehensive book, I'm not sure whether, the average person would have read it. What do you think?
I agree. I actually had a lot of help from family and friends in terms of helping me refine the message, and to some, close people to me that they're not necessarily Bitcoiners or finance people. They said, the first half is really good. I'm enjoying it, but then you're starting to lose me as we get into the dollar, as we get into the Fed. Some of the later Bitcoin stuff and the CBDC chapter as well. So I had to dial back a lot of the detail. I had to really make it more clear so that anybody can pick up this book. And that was my goal with Layered Money, is write a book that explains money to somebody who isn't necessarily a finance person, has never taken an accounting course. I'm a adjunct professor at University of Southern California here in Los Angeles. And my students have a prerequisite of accounting and some sort of micro or macroeconomics. So you have to have an understanding of discounting cash flows and assets and liabilities to take my class. But I didn't want that to be the case for the book. I wanted it to be something that anybody could read.
Okay, you just mentioned your professor. I was going to ask you, like, what is because with Bitcoin, once you go into the rabbit hole of Bitcoin for the first time, you face this fundamental, never experienced question, like, what is money? Now, with your book, the Layered Money, what's the subtitle? It's from gold
Yes,
to
it's from gold and dollars to Bitcoin and central bank digital currencies. So the past layers are gold and the dollar system. The future is Bitcoin and all other digital currencies.
Okay. Let me ask you first, what is the motivation and the intention and the call to action when you wrote that book? I mean, I guess you want to, cause and effect. Because I was thinking, what if, your book or maybe other books like Safiya Namouz were taught at schools, not only at universities, at colleges, but like at schools, like for the mature mind. How would people, change your behavior, monetary wise, economically, in terms of comprehension?
That's a great question. Yeah. The call to action of the book is to express that Bitcoin is a freedom tool and that our current monetary system doesn't have to be tied to governments in the way that it currently is. This idea of separation of money and state is something that is well known to people in Bitcoin and something that they advocate for. And so I wanted to tell that story properly, how money and state merged, and why it doesn't necessarily have to be like that. and how Bitcoin is a tool of empowerment, and it because it's a denomination. And so one thing I do in the book is I trace the root of the word denomination. The root is nomen. It means name in Latin. So a denomination is how we name our wealth. How do we name our labor? And how do we name our blood, sweat, and tears? If you are locked in to a denomination, meaning you don't have freedom of denomination, then that is in antithesis of freedom and things that I believe in, that we should be free to do things on this planet. Not that governments need to go away tomorrow, but that I should have the right to denominate my labor or my savings in any currency that I choose. Bitcoin gives the world for the first time the ability to denominate their wealth, their earnings, their labor in a different currency that's not tied to a government that isn't subject to devaluation from any central party. And so these are like classic Bitcoin, these are classic Bitcoin explanations, motivations, but I did want to encapture all these ideas of freedom of currency denomination, which is the title of the conclusion, chapter 10, and this idea that money and state merged in the 17th century formally, and for quite some time before that, if you want to go back to the Roman Empire. And it doesn't have to be like that going forward. And we can use government currencies and Bitcoin in tandem together as separate tools for separate things.
That's fascinating that you just brought it up, because I was going to bring up that quote that you wrote. I have the ebook, so I can't give you the page number, but I guess you know what I'm talking about. It's exactly that chapter, freedom of currency and denomination of currency denomination. And it's your quote out of your book, "But in the digital age, money and state don't necessarily mix anymore. To many, the entire concept of government money is becoming obsolete on the rise of as the rise of Bitcoin bellows in antithesis." I'm not sure whether people really are grasping the fundamental nature, the fundamental implications, what that means, for us as a society, as individual, as sovereign individual, as human civilization. Do you want to elaborate a little bit on that?
Yeah, in the West, you're in Europe, I'm in the United States, it's harder for people to grasp this idea that we don't need our government currencies, and we don't need them. I think the people that own Bitcoin in the West are doing so either because they have an advanced understanding of the technology, or they have an advanced understanding of the monetary system. So I would classify myself as the latter. I have an advanced understanding of our monetary system. And for that reason, I'm seeking a wealth storage tool that doesn't have to do with the dollar system. Many Bitcoiners in the United States and Europe are doing that same thing. There are also, of course, the first adopters in the West that were doing so because they understood what a brilliant technology Bitcoin was and is. So that's what the motivation in the West has been. But you have to step into the shoes of people in Latin America and Africa and Southeast Asia and South Asia that have currencies that are not stable, have no track record of stability, and they don't trust their governments at all as a populace. In the West, half the people trust the government and half the people don't. But in Latin America and Africa, it's not like that. It's most people don't trust the government. Most people don't trust the currency. Most people have other ways to store their money besides their own government currencies, like US dollar paper money. Right, that is one of the primary wealth storage tools in Latin America and Africa is Benjamins, dollar bills, right? And so they understand this idea fundamentally that we don't need government currencies. People in the United States and Europe, generally speaking, as a populace don't have that. So it really is a tale of two worlds here. And both, I think that both the West and other parts of the world that don't have trustworthy government currencies are speaking to each other over the last 3-4 years of this Bitcoin, this rise of Bitcoin beyond the computer science contingent. As the global banking system, central banks, and the international community starts talking about Bitcoin as they have over the last half decade, both sides of the story are speaking to each other. People that are writing about human rights in Bitcoin, like Alex Gladstein, for example, he's bringing messages from Venezuela and other parts of Latin America to us in the United States, how Bitcoin is being used. People like Matt Alborg that are doing research in Nigeria on how Bitcoin is being used are bringing that knowledge to us. They know that we're buying Bitcoin because we want the price to go up and we are not agreeing with the Fed and the ECB unlimited QE policies. But we have to understand why they're buying it. And they're not buying it. They are allocating to it in their daily activities to build in a protection mechanism for their earnings and their wealth. We have to understand them. And part of my book was, you know, bring an example of somebody in Nigeria that uses Bitcoin for empowerment. Make people understand that the West and the East or the Southern Hemisphere are different in their approaches to Bitcoin. And so those were some of my goals with Layered Money.
Would you say that if I want to use Parker Lewis' term, the gradual and suddenly phrase, would you say the adoption rate could be like surprising in some parts of the world, as you've been, you know, just describing, on whatever continent, would it be South America, Latin America, Southeast Asia, or, you know, Iran, Venezuela? Could you anticipate that? Do you think we could anticipate that?
Yes, I think that there are countries in Asia, Africa, and Latin America that could have, and I think it would come from something more official, like a government announcement, where you could see Bitcoin adoption happen extremely quickly and go from 5% to 90% in the span of 1 year. I think that could happen if, for example, a government makes an announcement that we are going to semi-back our currency with Bitcoin, the central bank has purchased Bitcoin so that we can stabilize our currency, or things like we're abandoning our currency. I mean, something like that, I couldn't necessarily imagine it happening in the next 12 months, but it could surprise us. And if it does happen in the next 5 years, in any of those countries, Bitcoin adoption goes to 90%+ in any of those countries, essentially overnight. So I do feel like going forward, we're going to have less currencies in 5 years than we do today, government currencies. Currencies will cease to exist because they can't compete with the dollar and Bitcoin. They're just outcompeted. And it's too expensive to try to stabilize your currency in Bitcoin terms or in dollar terms for some of these countries. And by too expensive, I mean they have to then turn the printing press on, their own printing press, to support their currency, you know, and that's not a sustainable situation for a currency that doesn't have this type of global reserve status that the dollar and the euro have.
You know, for people who might come, you know, totally as noobs or just out of curiosity, because Bitcoin has become mainstream, or find, you know, because of number go up, they're finally coming into this space. And could you describe to some of these people, you know, with all the properties of Bitcoin, you know, full auditability, transparency, instantaneous settlement, not only on-chain, but, you know, with the rapidly evolving technologies of whatever Jack Mahler, Strike, or second, third layer, whatever, might come. So there's a whole paradigm shift going on. Is it possible for you to describe a world, what the world could look like? Let's be a little bit more specific, the reduction in damages, collateral damages, you know, on a societal level, on economical level. Do you want to comment on that?
You know, I'm going to be very honest with you. There are, you know, people like Robert Breedlove that they're building a whole school of thought around the question that you just asked. What are the societal benefits going forward from this type of change? So I'm gonna not answer the question other than just saying, I believe Bitcoin is a force for good. It will change the world for the better, and that we will have less collateral damage from monetary systems in the future than we do today. That is part of why I believe in Bitcoin. It's part of why I'm so passionate about Bitcoin. But there are great writers right now and philosophers, new Bitcoin philosophers that are exploring these topics. So I would point people to Robert Breedlove and other, you know, writers out there that are doing a fantastic job of reimagining our future and whatever societal benefits that we'll get from a Bitcoin centric monetary system.
Yeah, and I also, I have had Jeff Booth on also on the show. I love his perspectives and his comprehension of what, you know, deflation means, deflation economics, and that the technology is inherently deflationary, and what that could mean, you know, rooted in, or I can imagine, you know, what you're describing in your book, you know, layered money, but in rooted in Bitcoin with all the technologies beyond, you know, the digital realm, and what that could, you know, trigger a cascade of chain reaction in the technological sector, in the societal sector, what have you. Okay. There's another quote which I wrote down. It says, all cashiers were forced to surrender precious metal to the Bank of Amsterdam and were issued Bank of Amsterdam deposits in return. And you describe, you know, this was actually the first central bank. And what I really find shocking or insightful, you continue writing and you say, it was sort of a purview into the financial relationships between its patrons. And I want to, you know, make this connection to the central bank digital currencies. What kind of hugely potential misuse of all this data, I mean, of the centralized control. I mean, they're already having such a centralized control. They're untouchable. They have criminal immunity, you know, starting from the Bank of International Settlement, which I wanted to have your opinion too. What is the role? Because I knew, you know, you wanted to keep it short and compact, but is there like, do you have an opinion on the role of the Bank of International Settlement and on that quote with all these intricacies that we could be facing?
Yes, that's a great question. So let's start with this concept of purview from the CBDC perspective. Yes, right now, the ability to analyze financial relationships between people is at the commercial banking level, because people use the banking system to transfer money to each other and to store money in deposit form. So when the government tries to surveil its populace and see what are our citizens doing, what kind of shenanigans are they getting up to, what kind of things can we censor or legislate against, or who can we go after, who can we tax, who's evading taxes, all of these things have to be done with a joint banking government cooperation. And the Fed also as the whole regulatory framework for the banking system. CBDCs if they are starting to replace the banking system as the way people store their money, then that gives the government the ability to skip over this having to go to the banks to audit their records, and or even the ability for banks to launder money for people if it's going all the way there. Now, in the US, it's going to be slow. We're not all going to be using Fed coins very soon. I think that's very far away, but we do have to imagine these sort of things. And it does bring this idea of financial surveillance into the forefront and make us think that, wow, if we have Fed coins or digital euros, the ECB and the Fed, they can see everything that we're doing. That's just the natural result of us having a wallet with their coin in it. You know how much blockchain forensics go on in Bitcoin today. So imagine all that power with the Fed without having to design software for it. They built it from the beginning to be able to watch everything, to have flags go up when things go on that don't meet their eye. And so that's, you know, going to be interesting. And I forget the second part of your question.
Thanks for that. What do you think is the role of the Bank of International Settlements?
Right. So that's going to be interesting. It might become a clearinghouse for CBDCs. They might set some sort of guidance on how CBDCs should be issued, what type of software distributed ledger technology should be used, what type of swaps are allowed between digital currencies from country to country or from central bank to central bank. So I'm not sure, but what I do know is that the BIS is one of the thought leaders in central bank digital currencies. They are hesitant but willing to credit Bitcoin as the inspiration for a lot of it. At least they were at the beginning. And now they're trying to pretend that Bitcoin doesn't exist so they can build their financial system in their own eye. Because if they have to admit that government currencies aren't demanded as much today as they were yesterday, then that shakes up their framework. They have to think with blinders on. So I do see them as kind of the guiding ship for central bank digital currencies. And they've published a lot of papers, and now they have regular publications on what they believe the technology should be. And again, nothing to do with Bitcoin right now at the BIS at all.
Yeah, because I did a lot of reading about the Bank of International Settlement, whatever material was available. And I mean, as far as I'm informed, the Bank of International Settlements is owned, right, by the majority of the, you know, biggest central bank or the owners and shareholders of the central banks. But it's all, you know, very mystified and obscure. So this is something, you know, a topic of real thrilling interest to me. Okay, so there's no coincidence that you wrote an excellent article today, why $1 million Bitcoin is coming. And I see you probably in a few months with another article where you say again, oh, this was too bearish. So do you want to like comment a little bit on your article? How did you get to write this article?
Yeah, CoinDesk approached me and they said, you know, we can see that your book is generating a lot of interest in the community, and we'd love to have you write an opinion piece for us. So I accepted, and I really appreciate their offer, and was really happy to write something. And so they said, you can write whatever you want. So I thought about what to write about, and I didn't want to bore anybody with going on about layered money, because I've been doing that for several weeks now, and you know, the book is out there. People are loving it and recommending it. So, you know, I wanted to write something fresh, and I thought about what was the biggest news item since I published the book, and it was the purchase of $1.5 billion worth of Bitcoin by Tesla. And so I, you know, been just thinking about how Bitcoin is moving. In layered money, I use gold as this reference point. I tell a 1,000-year story about gold, and I even use the current market value of gold as a, you know, reference point to where Bitcoin's price could reach, you know, in the next few years, which is approximately $500,000 given a market cap of $10 trillion worth of gold. So divided by about 20 million coins, we get about $500,000 Bitcoin. Now that was, I think it was a good way for me to ground my book and to ground the readers in, you know, imagining the future and, you know, where Bitcoin could go. But now that we look at corporate treasuries coming into Bitcoin, what I thought about, I said, what if, you know, there was $1 trillion in demand that came into Bitcoin with Bitcoin at a market cap of 1 trillion? Would that mean that Bitcoin doubles to 2 trillion in market cap? Oh no, it's going to go multiples of that. So then I thought, how can we estimate, because it's impossible to calculate, but how can we estimate the multiplier effect of these huge purchases? So I toyed with a lot of numbers and I did a very unscientific way, but I basically, you know, attributed 1/6 of the most recent price rise of Bitcoin to the purchases from Tesla and MicroStrategy since December.
And, you know, when we think about it, this is like a, you know, how should I call it? We say in German, it's sort of a small drop on a hot stone. So, I mean, you know, when BlackRock comes and says, like, you know, sort of make their semi-official statements where they're dabbling in, you know, I mean, they've got like trillions and trillions assets under management. So we haven't really seen the you know, the huge chunks of not even to mention pension funds. I mean, this could go so fast, exponentially fast and surprisingly fast. I think we can't even fathom because we're what at $1 trillion market cap. That's what 1/10 of our already of our gold's market cap, plus minus or something like that. Mm-hmm. And then with that, you know, of course, when the number go up, you know, and going mainstream, it creates this self-feeding prophecy, or what do you call it? This self-fulfilling prophecy. And who was it? Hal Finney or Satoshi Nakamoto himself, he says, you know, you should get some in case if it catches on. So it creates this demand. And I was just talking to Hess McCook today because he writes really excellent article. I said, you know, what would it take? Just, you know, forget all the institutions or corporations, the average person, the plebs, as we, you know, we would call them, you know, the average person out there, just to reach, you know, let's say a few $1 trillion market cap. And he said, you know, it would just take maybe 4% of the population making $10 out of DCA every day or something like that. So it's really like a super small critical mass that it will require to, you know, to reach that multi-trillion-dollar market cap. Isn't that amazing? I mean,
yeah, it is amazing. That's what I wanted to do, is just imagine, give people a little life to their imagination that $1 million Bitcoin is not that bullish. It's just not, because if you look at the demand that could come into Bitcoin, all the people, institutions, companies, countries, central banks that own zero Bitcoin, all the retirement investment funds that own zero Bitcoin. And now actually, by the way, most of them own some Bitcoin because most of them own some S&P 500, which owns Tesla, which owns Bitcoin. So now they are allocated, but in the most minute way. And yeah, I mean, $1 trillion of demand coming into Bitcoin could trigger a $25 trillion increase in its market cap, which is a $1.3 million price of Bitcoin. So it actually is so much more easy. I mean, it's really easier for me to imagine $1 million Bitcoin in a post-Elon world than it was before. And I've been very bullish on Bitcoin, you know, for a few years now. So it was, you know, one of those rude awakenings to me that, wait a second, I'm not even bullish enough. And so I wanted to write about that.
You know, Nick, what is so really mind-boggling when you think about it, and you wrote about that, you know, too, in your article, it's like, or in your book, like 12 years into its existence, and it's this monetary evolution at a rate of speed we can't even fathom. I mean, when you compare that to the adoption rate of other technologies, I'm like, I was going to ask you, like, what would you say is the critical number of people, you know, adopting Bitcoin, whatever, hodling Bitcoin, saving Bitcoin, using Bitcoin? Would that be like 500 million people or even less?
I honestly think we passed it during this pandemic and the last breakout. Really? Above 20,000. I think we passed the point that that we're going to a billion. I mean, we've reached 100 million Bitcoin users, or let's call it cryptocurrency users, to be just more inclusive to this technology revolution. But we're talking about maybe 100 million people that own Bitcoin on some exchange or with their own custody around the world now. That is so, I mean, it's such a large number. It almost guarantees that we get to a billion. You know, people are sending me DMs and saying, I'm buying 15 copies of your book for my friends and family. So,
amazing.
This is the adoption multiplier. And when you're at 100 million people already, and the number goes up, and listen, also, the people who are constantly dismissing Bitcoin are starting to look really silly.
Especially the so-called, you know, whatever intellectual branded people, like, I mean, Nassim Taleb, who wrote the forewords to, you know, Safed, I mean, it's so, I mean, it's getting a little bit embarrassing. I mean, what is your take on that? I mean, you know, they're making a clown of themselves. I mean, they're insulting their own intelligence. This is what I'm concerned about, you know?
They are. They're not long enough. And that's the problem, is that they're not long enough. And so, dude, haters gonna hate. It's like, I don't know what better way to describe it. And
Bitcoin derangement syndrome, isn't that what it's called?
Bitcoin derangement syndrome is a great one. I haven't heard that one before, but it really is. I mean, listen, 5 years ago, when I'm falling down the Bitcoin rabbit hole and trying to debate Bitcoin with no coiners, that's fun. And it's like, that's a challenge. And you have to try to show, you know, you have to show out of the box thinking. Today, I mean, if someone is trying to argue with you about Bitcoin, that like, it's not backed by anything, or like, it's a figment of your imagination, or it's just a bubble, and it's tulips all over again, you really shouldn't waste your time now. It's like, their time for you to, you know, engage in that argument has passed. Now we have to build a financial system, here's a new way to respond to that argument, or like, the government's going to ban Bitcoin. That's my favorite one. It's like, excuse me, have you heard of a company called Coinbase? Do you think that the US government is going to come in and ban Bitcoin when companies like Coinbase, and not to mention Fidelity Investments and Bank of New York Mellon, have fully embraced this technology? It's like, they're so delusional. And that's part of why I wrote this article about Bitcoin going to a million, because it's the time to like argue about Bitcoin's merits, I think, has passed. Let's actually shift the argument into, how quickly is Bitcoin going to eat the monetary system? That is the new argument about Bitcoin, not whether or not it has merit. That is just, and you know, it's okay also that people don't want to adopt it yet. That makes the short cover that much more violent in the future, And that's, you know, it's what you see when the price goes up. It's a short covering in theory, because everyone is short Bitcoin until you own some. If the future of the monetary system is Bitcoin centric and you don't own any Bitcoin, then you're short Bitcoin. This is also a very popular meme that's taking root that I love. If you're not long Bitcoin, you're short. I've been saying this for a long time and been writing about it for a long time as well.
That's fascinating. Nick, what is your position? Because, you know, we've been talking, we've been having discussions with Dave Collum and Eric Vasquill previously, with Eric Kaysen also. You know, because Eric Vasquill always says, you know, Bitcoin is a black market money. And I think that, you know, it's not the concern that the government cannot, you know, you cannot ban Bitcoin, but what they could, and that is a concern, is sort of, is there going to be a white market and black market? Is the government going to step in the intersection between users, merchants, you know, in the transactional level, on the transactional level, when it comes to taxation, which is, you know, in whatever form, a form of a theft, a systemic theft. Do you think that's going to happen? I mean, you know, this splintering of markets, white market, black markets, or trying sort of to tax people, you know?
Well, it all comes down to taxes. So yeah. I'm going to ignore the first part of your question where you say, can the government come in and make a black market or white market? But let's focus on this idea of taxes and that Bitcoin gives people a route around it. And so that is one of the things that scares governments the most, if we're being frank, is the ability to evade taxes through a brand new denomination that they can't control, and they don't have a central bank to route payments or to surveil. They have to surveil from the outside, and they have to come in and collect taxes from the outside. And so governments will continue to levy tax on people. And then the way that the people, and this is not United States or West centric, but the way that people engage with Bitcoin and the willingness that they have to convert their Bitcoin to domestic currency to pay a tax bill that's levied by their government, it's going to change. It's going to change the way taxes are collected, taxes are levied, and the way that people, the willingness of people to pay taxes. And again, that comes back to the separation of money and state. And it's all the same topic here, is that if we separate money and state, what is the true nature of the taxes that are levied today, whether through inflation or income tax or other taxes? And so there's so many different types of taxes. It's a topic that I'm passionate about, but that, you know, it's hard to speculate about what governments will do from a tax perspective. So it's going to be something I'm interested to watch. And I will, you know, look to see how governments are changing their attitude toward tax collection in countries not named the United States of America, and see who are the leaders in a Bitcoin world. Is it going to be Singapore, Switzerland? Which countries are going to be at the forefront in freedom of currency denomination? How can you show to the world that you are friendly to the idea of freedom of currency denomination? The United States, I promise you, won't be one of the first countries that makes that commitment. Singapore, Switzerland are two countries that are very prominent countries on the world stage, are becoming very Bitcoin friendly. So I don't want to single them out as the two to watch, but let's watch them and the others that are making these types of announcements to embrace Bitcoin. And I'm not saying the government of the United States or of Europe is unfriendly. I would say the US is very friendly relative to, let's say, Europe, who just seems so scared by Bitcoin. They seem scared out of their wits. Americans embrace the entrepreneurship mentality of Bitcoiners, I think, at a fundamental basis. We have people in Congress, both sides of the aisle, that are very friendly to this idea that Bitcoin is a form of speech and a freedom tool, and Americans should be allowed to use it as they so please. But, you know, let's watch which countries say you may denominate everything in Bitcoin, and you don't have to pay taxes when converting between domestic currency and Bitcoin, like at the top level. Let's watch and see who's there and what type of FOMO that creates in other countries that want to compete on the new world stage that aren't named, you know, United States of America.
Yeah, and if we stay in the United States, I mean, just look at Wyoming, intrastate-wise. I mean, this rise of competition, or not, you know, this special jurisdiction that's now being created, sort of so-called, as Caitlin Long calls it, crypto-friendly, whatever. Do you see like more jurisdictional arbitrage? I mean, I want to tie this in with my final wrap-up question for you. Like, what is your vision for the next 10, 20 years? Is there going to be more competition, more free private cities? You know, if I talk to Titus Gebel, Free Private Cities was really fascinating, together with Jeff Booth. So what is your vision? Like, what is your perspective for people, you know, who are seeking freedom or just want to, you know, live their lives, be an entrepreneur, save money for themselves and their children, their posterity, and have a happy life.
Yeah. This is the stuff that Balaji Srinivasan talks about. It's the stuff that the Bitcoin Citadel contingent loves to talk about. But in the end, jurisdictional arbitrage has absolutely dominated the way that business is done on the world stage since I've been born. And so to think that's going to slow down, Bitcoin accelerates that. It accelerates it so much. And so jurisdictional arbitrage is the name of the game. You saw in Coinbase's filing, no headquarters, no address listed. That's awesome. And so let's see what Bitcoin does. Again, the dreaming of the societal benefits of Bitcoin is something that I think it's something more private. It gets into your politics. It gets into your family values. What do you hope Bitcoin creates for the future is really like how you see your best life, and it's something that is a little personal. And that's why I commend, again, guys like Robert Breedlove, who are willing to just, you know, spill it all out there and say, you know, this is going to change the world in so many different ways. People like that stoke our imagination and how we see the future. So, I hope that I believe that Bitcoin is a tool that will change the world. That's why I'm involved in Bitcoin. And, I'm excited to see, to raise my daughter in a Bitcoin world, and see the good that can come out of that.
Yeah, this is something we've been talking, you know, with my girlfriend and you know, for our daughter now, who is like 2 months old, like, you know, what kind of world is she going to live in, you know, whether I'm still alive or not, you know, after that, what's the future going to look like? You know, I mean, with everything going on right now, with all the tyrannical measures and things that are going on, it's really, it's worrisome. It's extremely worrisome. And, a child needs the right environmental conditions to prosper, to be creative, to, you know, to think freely, to make the best versions of her, himself. So, yeah. So really enjoyed this talk, Nick. Where can people follow you?
Yeah. Well, I just want to say I'm super bullish on humanity. I've had the ability to travel to many countries and meet people from all over the world. People are loving, brilliant. They care about the planet. They care about their families. They care about the future. And so I think that Bitcoin will bring about a great change, going forward. People can find me at layeredmoney.com. Go check out the book on Amazon and other retailers worldwide, Layered Money. It's a short read, and people are really enjoying the book so far. So I hope that people will go check it out. And you can follow me on Twitter at time value of BTC.
Well, thank you so much, Nick. I mean, I can't recommend it enough. I've got to get the hardcover too, by the way. So maybe we'll see each other at some conference. Hopefully in the future, traveling is more, eased up. So Nick, thank you so much and hope to talk to you soon in the very near future. Okay.
Thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
Take care. Bye-bye. Well, how was that? Nick Bhatia is like a genius writer, a brilliant writer, brilliant think tank and thinker and Bitcoiner. In my opinion, he's like, with all his humilities, he's really a genius. So make sure you follow him, read the book, whatever ebook, hardcover, order it. You can read it like within a day or less, within a few hours. Yeah, I had read it, but I'm still reading, some parts of it over and over again, because it's so fascinating, not only historically, but also, deeply deep into the rabbit hole of what is money, what is layered money, the intricacies, the interconnections, and the implications of what it would mean eventually, layered money rooted in Bitcoin or fundamentally rooted in Bitcoin. So if you have any questions, comments, or suggestions for future discussions, make sure you also read Nick Bhatia's latest article on CoinDesk. I'm gonna put those all in the show notes. And Layered Money, his book is a bestseller right now with amazing reviews, and I can't recommend it strongly enough. My name is Keyvan Davani, the Keyvan Davani Connection, and hope to talk to you soon. And take care. Bye.